From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. White supremacy has seen a major resurgence in the U.S. tied to the political rise of Donald Trump. It's a notion deeply tied to the origins of a country founded on the genocide of indigenous people and the enslavement of Africans. Now a new book points out that the idea of whiteness as a tangible concept originated from religion. Who was allowed to be Christian and free, and especially who was allowed to exercise political power and democratic freedoms, defined the idea of whiteness. In the book, Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World, author Catherine Gerbner traces that history, offering a framework for today's white supremacist resurgence. Catherine teaches history at the University of Minnesota, and she now joins me. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So for people who aren't as familiar with the history of slavery in the Americas in general, one might be surprised that Barbados, the Caribbean island of Barbados, figures centrally in this story. Tell us a little bit about why Barbados is central to this history.
You're right that Barbados isn't usually included in these broader histories of American slavery. And that's because it didn't basically revolt and join the American Revolution. It's not part of the United States now. But in the 17th century, it was probably the most important English colony in the Americas. And many of the slave laws originated in Barbados and were then later transported to North American colonies like South Carolina. So it's an absolutely central place for understanding, especially early American slavery.
So there, this idea of whiteness as a concept, it was not something that happened very early on in the institution of slavery, right? Initially, it was that Christianity was seen as synonymous with free men, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, we tend to think of slavery and we think about race-based slavery, but the earliest colonial slavery policies were actually based on religious difference. And so you were allowed to enslave someone who wasn't Christian, but not to enslave another Christian. And so as a result, English slave-owning colonists thought that being a Christian and specifically being a Protestant was basically like being a free person. And as a result, they didn't want enslaved people to convert to Christianity.
So tell us about the Barbados Slave Code, as it was called, and how that first crystallized, you know, documented the notion of Christianity as being, you know, synonymous with freedom, and also the way in which it institutionalized just the idea of enslaved people as inferior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the things that I did in my research is I went back and read this earliest slave code in the English colonies. It was in 1660 in Barbados. And what you see is that basically enslaved people are conceived of in the law as being non-Christian. And so the word Christian is used to refer specifically to what we would now say as white people, Europeans, people of European descent. And so the way I interpreted this was I realized that slave owners were using Christianity and religious difference to basically create the fundamental difference between enslaved people and free people. And this forms the backbone of slave law in the early English colonies.
And when we say Christianity, we don't just mean, Christianity in the most broad terms. You're specifically referring to Protestant Christianity, right?
Yes, that's correct. And in Barbados and most of the other English colonies, this would be the Church of England that was the established Protestant church at the time.
Now, the idea of how to identify the enslaved people as slaves, as inferior, as unchristian is also part of the story. Was the Barbados Slave Code the first instance or among the first instances of that historical word Negro that was used?
Well, the word Negro has a longer history. It comes from the Spanish, which means black.
Negro, yeah.
And Yeah, exactly. And so what you see there is this is evidence of how the English, when they founded their slave colonies, they were in some ways imitating Catholic Spanish practices. And so Negro is sort of a remnant of that history, of that sort of longer Catholic history with slavery. But then there were many new things that the English added into it that were not the same as sort of the slave law in the Catholic colonies, where all enslaved people were supposed to be baptized as Catholics. This was a very big difference between Catholic colonies and Protestant ones.
Right. And I want to get to that in just a minute, but just staying on the term, by using the term Negro, weren't they identifying color right away?
Yes, and so color is important, right? So there is this idea that people of African descent, they have a different skin complexion, but at the same time, the word white had not yet developed. And so the full sort of concept of racial difference as we understand it now was not developed. And I think it is very interesting that this word Negro was we can find it earlier in the English slave colonial records than the word white, which comes quite later.
So the Protestant slave colonies had the stark difference with the Catholic ones in that enslaved people were not allowed to be Christian because Christianity was synonymous with freedom. Why were Catholic colonies open to and actually embracing the idea of baptizing enslaved people and actually converting them?
Right. This is it goes back quite a ways to the 15th century when Portuguese traders began to trade for enslaved Africans. And the Pope at that time basically issued a papal bull that said it's fine to enslave pagans, as they called them, but you must then also baptize them. And so the implicit or actually explicit justification for enslavement at that time among the Catholic empires became that you would enslave non-Christians, but then baptize them as Catholics. And so
So
that was the
slavery
problem.
became part of the project of conversion.
Exactly. And then there's no pope for Protestants. And so there was no centralized authority to tell these Protestant slave owners, when or why they should baptize an enslaved person. And at the same time, coming out of the Protestant Reformation, there's huge debates about when someone could be baptized and should be baptized. And so this is a huge debate among Protestants already. And the result is that Protestant slave owners actually have a huge amount of control over this question of when or why enslaved people should be baptized.
So, within the various Protestant strains, what were those differences? How do, for example, Quakers fit into this history? Today, we think of Quakerism as among the most sort of, peace and justice loving of the Protestant communities. How did the early Quakers treat slavery and Christianity?
Well, this was one of the most surprising aspects of my research, and actually, it was one of the reasons I ended up writing this book in the first place, because we think of Quakers as abolitionists. But what I found is that in the 17th century, most Quakers in the American colonies actually owned slaves. And the Quaker founder George Fox went to Barbados and he spoke to Quakers there. And he said something that was radical at the time, but it was not anti-slavery. He said that Quakers should allow enslaved people to join with them in worship and allow them to become Quakers. And that was because slave owners were, in general, very much against allowing enslaved people to become Christians. This was a radical statement, but it was also one that actually had the ironic side effect of really reconciling Christianity and slavery and creating an argument for later Protestant missionaries to make this statement that Christianity and slavery could go hand in hand.
So let's explore that further because this, of course, is absolutely critical. Even today, you have men like Jeff Sessions, who claim to be incredibly religious, Mike Pence, who claim to be incredibly religious and yet are on the part of the project of white supremacy, whether they openly admit it or not. So, how did Protestants reconcile Christianity with slavery?
Well, you know, it takes a lot of mental gymnastics, but they managed to do so. I mean, basically, the Protestant missionaries could point to some instances in the Old Testament where there are examples of slavery. And then they also sort of invented the kind of what we would now say are kind of crazy interpretations of particular passages. One is the curse of Ham, which in the Bible, there's no reference to Africans or race, but pro-slavery missionaries and later pro-slavery apologists would use this verse from Genesis in order to claim that the Bible sanctions race-based slavery. You see a lot of sort of twisting of scriptural passages. And actually, I believe that the passage that Jeff Sessions referred to a few weeks ago, in Romans, to justify what the U.S. government was doing to separate families was a passage that some slave owners have used in order to justify slavery.
So these questions, of course, remaining so relevant today. Now, how did this thinking evolve? Because what we are discussing is still rooted in what, the 17th century. How did the thinking evolve to the United States as slave owning states, or states where slavery remained legal, remained practiced? What was the situation for enslaved people being allowed to practice Christianity?
So what happens over time is, in the 17th century, slave owners don't want enslaved people to become Christian, but Protestant missionaries and enslaved people themselves sort of change the dynamic as enslaved people sort of fight to become Protestants, and as missionaries make these really strong arguments about how Christian slaves would be more obedient than non-Christian slaves. And so what you see is that by the time you get to the 19th century, sort of coming up to the Civil War, there's this whole arsenal of arguments that missionaries have created about how, slavery is a Christian institution, that Christian slaves are happy and obedient and loyal. And I don't think that that is actually how Christianity functions within enslaved communities, but it was this really powerful arguments that helped to defend the institution of slavery in the antebellum period against abolitionists.
So Christianity making, or the assertion that Christianity would make enslaved people more docile and more accepting of their fate in life.
Exactly, yes.
And of course, then in the lead up to the civil rights movement and what followed later, we have Christianity actually playing a very different role within African American communities. That's the topic of, I'm sure, many other books. But then staying on this idea of how Christianity and freedom still managed to be synonymous. How did enslaved people who managed to win their freedom see themselves as free and a Christian at the same time? And how did that then lead to the kinds of attacks that we saw to prevent African Americans from becoming full citizens? African American, the whole fight around the Voting Rights Act, you write in your book, is central to this idea of Christianity and racism and seeing the difference between black and white.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Really, what I found was that as some enslaved people were able to join churches and some were able to gain their freedom, these were now free black Christians, living in places like Barbados and trying to access the full rights of citizenship that they should have been able to attain, things like trying to vote and hold office. And what you see is that at this very moment when there is this critical mass of free black Christians in a slave society, the white slave owning, and they didn't call themselves white quite yet, the slave owning population, the slave owning lawmakers, introduce this word white as a new way to create a barrier between these free black Christians and the full rights of freedom. And so what you see here is this history of whiteness, not just sort of emerging out of nowhere, but it is actually a political tool that slave owners used to oppress free Black Christians, as well as to create a new justification for slavery that was based on race rather than religion.
And so that's the moment where the idea of whiteness sort of emerges?
Yeah, so I mean, you can find sort of the emergence of whiteness in different colonies at slightly different times, but I think that this was the moment that it really emerged in Barbados and then was sort of transported elsewhere. And it was, you know, based on my research, I found the very first evidence of whiteness being a prerequisite for voting, and that was in 1697, so much earlier than people have sort of have known.
Is that around when this idea of the one drop rule also comes into existence?
So this is very fascinating. The 1697 law doesn't refer to sort of a one drop rule. It just says you have to be white in order to vote. But then 12 years later, these Barbadian lawmakers come back and they amend their law, and they say that anyone who can be proved to have any ancestry that is African whatsoever shall not be considered to be white. And so the way I interpret this is that in those 12 years, there were people of mixed race who were Christian and free who tried to gain political power, and that this law was a response to those individuals, and it narrowed the definition of white to basically it's a one drop rule, right? Anyone who can be proven to have any African ancestry whatsoever cannot be considered to be white.
So can we then say that the idea of whiteness emerged as a direct reaction to freed slaves, to formerly enslaved African Americans wanting to exercise their full rights as Americans?
Yes, I think that is that was absolutely an impetus to use and utilize this new concept of whiteness.
What about Catholicism and slavery? We've sort of focused on the Protestant branch of it. How did Catholic slave-owning communities evolve?
Well, so in Catholic, and this, it varies quite a bit from place to place, of course, but in Catholic slave colonies, they actually have a very complex sort of system in which they determine sort of what percentage of various heritages one person has. It's very, I mean, if anyone has ever seen a Costa painting, they try to distinguish, you know, somebody who has one Native American grandparent, two European grandparents, and one African grandparent as like a specific, they have a specific term for that. So it's a sort of a much more complex system that isn't based on one drop, but is instead, I mean, it's hierarchical, absolutely, and it's insidious as well, but it's a different type of racial system.
Catherine, how did the idea of Christianity fit with, and Christianity, you know, expanding to enslaved communities, how did that, what's the history of that related to literacy among African Americans? Because in order to read the Bible, you have to know how to read. When you learn how to read, you basically find yourself feeling more powerful. You have more access to political power than you did before, right?
Yes, this is such an important part of the story because Protestant conversion, especially in the 17th and 18th centuries, was absolutely tied to literacy and education. And Protestants believed that you really should learn how to read the Bible and learn how to write in order to be a real true Christian. And enslaved people recognized this, and many of them flocked to missionaries to learn how to read and write and to gain these skills. And they did really powerful things with reading and writing. And I've found some incredible petitions written by enslaved and free Africans from the island of St. Thomas, writing to the King and Queen of Denmark, sort of trying to ask these monarchs to advocate on their behalf and to get the white people on the island to stop beating them for carrying Bibles, for example. Mm. Yes.
If Christianity was seen by slave owners as a tool to keep enslaved people docile, how did they treat the pursuit of freedom, by enslaved people?
Well, I think this is again where you see the rhetoric of the missionaries who are trying to say that Christian slaves would be more docile, hitting up against the reality of what Christianity meant to the enslaved people who actually did convert. So missionaries are trying to convince everyone that that enslaved people who are Christian will be loyal. Enslaved people who became Christian were actually really trying to, in many cases, advocate on their own behalf. And so you see a tension between what we could call, white missionary Christianity and then the emergence of Black Christianity.
So, eventually, do you see the notion of Christianity being synonymous with freedom become sort of come full circle again as freed slaves decided that being Christian and being free were consistent and that racial differences or skin complexion were irrelevant?
Well, I do think that enslaved people who chose to become Christian did really sort of think about Christianity and freedom as largely equivalent. And they saw their conversion to Christianity as a claim to freedom. I mean, each person was different, but I do think that this legacy, this idea that Christianity and freedom are synonymous, actually, missionaries try to say that's not true. But you do see it picked up by enslaved people themselves in their decisions to become Christian.
So, with all of this history, and this is, centuries-old history or spanning several centuries, how should we look at the attacks on the Voting Rights Act that we see today, the resurgence of white supremacy, the violence that we've seen by white supremacists, in Charlottesville, Virginia, over a year ago? Should we be rooting our analyses of these current events in this history?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it helps us to understand white supremacy a little bit better. I mean, there are strains of white supremacy that are fully sort of connected to this, the predecessor of Protestant supremacy, which is sort of what I term the anti-conversion sentiment among slave owners in the book. And so I think it's really important to see this connection between Protestant supremacy and what is now white supremacy. But I also think that really looking closely at the origins of whiteness and recognizing that race and especially whiteness, it's not just a part of our biology and it's more than just a social construct, that it was an intentionally used term that was intended for political purposes to oppress and stop free Black Christians from having political power. Can help us look anew at what is happening today. And I think it's especially important to look at terminology really closely. The way that the word white was being used in 1697 and 1709, what are the words that we're using today to basically exclude certain people from having access to the vote? So looking for coded language and the way that sort of racism has gone underground, I think is a way that we should approach our situation today.
I mean, that very much also helps understand the anti-immigrant rhetoric from people like Sessions and Miller, and of course Trump himself, where they see the influx of non-whites in this country as threatening the political power of whites. Never mind that immigrants might be overwhelmingly Christian. It seems as though that transition now from Christian to white in order to preserve white supremacy is sort of complete, right? No longer are we seeing very much about equating Christianity with freedom. Although there are evangelical Christians who do see that. There were a group of evangelical Christians that wrote to Christian organizations that wrote to President Trump, denouncing the family separation story and basically urging him to increase the number of refugees that are facing, you know, faith-based persecution around the world. Presumably they want Christian refugees. So how far has it come? Have we separated Christianity from whiteness, or is it still part of the story?
I think it depends on the Christians that we're looking at. I think that there are absolutely still practicing Christians today who view their Christianity and their whiteness as being inseparable and really connected with their privileges. Hmm. And then I think there are also Christians today who do not see things in that way. So, you know, Christianity is still contested. But I do think that this strain of Christianity that comes out of Protestant supremacy is still with us.
Well, Catherine, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Catherine Gerbner. She teaches history at the University of Minnesota. We've been discussing her new history book, Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now Instagram at RU with Sonali.